Welcome back to the program. I think that perhaps we can all agree on certain basic ideas, certain common threads that are currently running through the American experience. One is that the American experiment is in decline. Our politics and our public institutions are broken, and we simply don't know how to fix them. Corporations seem to have eviscerated much of the traditional liberal institutions that once served us well. In their place, we've established a kind of oligarchic system, which has intensified the class divide in America. A proliferation of fear, ignorance, and anger have become the primary symptoms of all of this, and it has given rise to a new breed of pseudo-patriotic rhetoric that, not unlike celebrity culture itself, leads to the very destruction of that which it reveres. In Yeats' words, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passion and intensity. This is the framework for our conversation this morning with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges. He is one of the great moral voices of our time. He has become a passionate advocate for peace, as well as for the weak, the poor, the marginalized, and those who endure oppression throughout the world. Chris Hedges is the best-selling author of Empire of Illusion and his powerful manifesto, Death of the Liberal Class. It is my pleasure to have him here today to talk about a new volume of his writing entitled The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. Chris Hedges, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. When we look back at history, we certainly see other troubling times that we have gotten through, whether it was the Civil War, the McCarthy era, certainly the turbulence of the 60s, the labor strife that existed at the turn of the last century. Is this time different? Is all the upheaval and the sense of brokenness that we are experiencing now really any different from these other times?
Yes, because we are spending down our natural capital at a very alarming rate, and as all civilizations that die do. But this time around, there will be no new people to conquer and exploit, no new lands to occupy. The consequences of continuing to embrace the profligate consumption and the hollowing out of the country, the destruction of our manufacturing class, the creation of a neo-feudal society run by an oligarchic elite, this time around are terminal, and terminal not only for us, but if we don't stop the halt on the ecosystem itself, terminal for much of the planet as well.
When you say terminal, talk about what you mean by that. I mean, is there cause for any hope at all within the context of the American experience at this point?
Well, the effects, let's just start environmentally. The effects of global warming have been known to climate scientists since the early 1970s, and yet we have done virtually nothing to respond to the release of carbon emissions, which are now somewhere around 400 parts per million, life as we know it being sustainable at about 350 parts per million. If we stopped all carbon emissions today, many climate scientists argue it would still rise to about 550 parts per million. And of course, we're not doing that. We have watched the Obama administration, as well as the leaders of the industrialized world, first go to Copenhagen and shred Kyoto, which was a very weak document to begin with. We have run up, as an empire, the largest deficits in human history, which, as Andrew Bacevich and others have pointed out, we can never repay. We're playing a very dangerous game with our currency. I don't pretend to know whether or not it'll work, but I think all of the economists, even those who support monetizing the debt, which means printing, in this case, $600 billion of new money, do concede that it, number one, it's a Hail Mary, and number two, if it doesn't work, it's catastrophic. Once currency collapses, all of the traditional or formal structures of power are instantly discredited. That is how, for instance, in the breakdown of the former Yugoslavia, which was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia, not by ancient ethnic hatreds, you coughed up some figures like Radovan Karadzic or Slobodan Milosevic, the lunatic fringe of the political establishment.
The other thing you point out is that the traditional mechanisms for change, the things that have allowed change from some of those crises in the past, that those traditional mechanisms for reform are just broken.
Right, and that's what's most dangerous, that the liberal class or liberal institutions within a capitalist democracy traditionally function to make incremental or piecemeal reform possible, so that when there are widespread grievances or injustices visited especially on the poor and the working class, there is a mechanism, a way within formal structures of power, these injustices can be addressed and ameliorated. The New Deal is the perfect example of how a functioning liberal class works. In my book, Death of the Liberal Class, sort of follow the trajectory, starting in World War I with the creation of the culture of fear and the permanent war economy, the destruction of radical movements decimated during the war. And yet on the eve of the war, these movements had terrified the power elite. We had about three dozen socialist mayors. Appeal to Reason, which was a socialist journal, had the fourth highest circulation of any publication in the country. Powerful populist orators, people like Eugene Debs, who even in 1920, while sitting in a prison cell, managed to pull 1 million votes. So you saw the destruction of these populist or radical movements that kept the liberal class not only honest, I think, but positioned the liberal class as what it traditionally should be, which is the center between business interests, corporate interests, oligarchic interests, and the interests of the disenfranchised. So with the destruction through the Red Scares of the of radical movements like the Wobblies, the old CIO, those constant witch hunts for anyone who was considered soft on communism, and the disemboweling of liberal institutions themselves, so that by the 1950s, we have thousands of university professors, high school teachers, State Department officials, journalists, figures like I.F. Stone, arguably the country's greatest investigative journalist, they become pariahs. I.F. Stone, for example, can't even get a job on The Nation magazine, and ends up printing I.F. Stone, self-publishing I.F. Stone's weekly in the basement of his house. So there were no mechanisms when these powerful corporate interests began to dismantle the regulatory and governmental reforms that had largely been put in place by the New Deal to protect the citizenry. And this was furthered by self-identified liberals, people like Bill Clinton, later Barack Obama, but the Democratic Party as a whole, which understood that if they did corporate bidding, they would get corporate money. So that you had, by the 1990s, fundraising parity. The Democrats had fundraising parity with the Republicans, but the cost of that was that they portrayed their traditional constituency, which was labor and the working class, with NAFTA, with destruction of welfare, deregulation of the FCC, and, of course, deregulation of the banking system.
Of course, that constituency seemed to shrink as time went on, that in many ways the political process was not leading but simply reacting to other forces at play in society.
Well, you're right that there was a shrinkage, but it began immediately after the war with the passage of the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act, which was the most destructive piece of legislation for labor, crippling the ability of labor to organize and strike, until, one could argue, NAFTA. So while there was, as you correctly point out, a diminishing of these forces, this wasn't accidental. This wasn't part of any kind of natural development, but part of a stripping of empowerment, stripping of protection offered to these forces, so that by the 1970s, you have what the Harvard historian Charles Mayer calls a shift in America from an empire of production to what he calls an empire of consumption. And so workers' wages, which from the early 70s until now have either declined or remained largely stagnant for about 90% of the workforce, are sustained through credit, through borrowing, through debt, as well as through the capacity to buy cheap manufactured goods. And Sheldon Wolin, probably our greatest living political philosopher in Democracy Incorporated, argues that these are the two opiates that kept the political the populace politically passive as they were stripped of power. Now, of course, that credit is dried up. these cheap manufactured goods are no longer cheap, especially with gas prices approaching $4 a gallon and by most counts expected to rise. And you get a shift from Huxley's New World State to Orwell's much more naked sort of forms of control in 1984. So we were sort of pacified as this process took place.
What happened in the 60s? You talk about the radical and populist movements that were essentially snuffed out as a result of the Cold War and the Red Scare. There was a sense that these movements in the form of the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, feminism, and other things were beginning to take root again in the 60s. What happened?
The whatever progress, and there was progress made by African Americans, by women, gay rights movement, was not connected with economic progress. And if you remember at the end of King's life, he began to speak very bitterly about what was happening in the United States. He goes to Watts, for instance, after the riots and says, "They've turned my dream into a nightmare." He begins to talk about whites, even white liberals, as unconscious racists. He talks about blighted inner-city enclaves as internal colonies. He says there can be no racial justice until there is economic justice. And all of these movements were largely disconnected from labor. Labor, and of course, was antagonistic to the anti-war movement, initially very antagonistic to the civil rights movement. The AFL-CIO was headed by figures like Lane Kirkland and George Meany, who supported the War of Indochina, supported Nixon. And this was very different from radical movements at the turn of the century, which were integrated with labor. And I think that while much of these movements focused on inclusiveness, desegregation, tolerance, all of which are good, they forgot the primacy of economic justice, and that's what's led us to the state we're in now.
Where in this equation did the whole idea of ignorance and kind of magical thinking enter into the equation in such a way as to make logic and reason impossible in the body politic?
Well, in Death of the Liberal Class, I really go all the way back again to World War One, because what happened in World War One, it ends up being, I think, a seminal moment in American history. And Woodrow Wilson, for me, comes across as a very dark figure in American history. The war had no popular support. World War One, Wilson indeed had run for re-election on the slogan "He kept us out of the war," but with the collapse of the Russian front, with Tsarist Russia, the capacity of the Germans to move tremendous forces over the Western Front terrified the bankers in the United States and Wall Street, who had lent tremendous sums of money to the British and the French. And so there was heavy pressure to get into the war, since if the British and French were defeated, these loans would never be repaid. And Wilson plunged us into the war, and yet it had no popular support. So he created the first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, known popularly as the Creel Commission, because it was headed by a figure named George Creel, who ends his career working for Nixon and McCarthy in the House on American Affairs Activity hearings. Not only do they employ, they create their own news bureau, their own film division out of Hollywood, making movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin, and speakers' bureaus, not only do they saturate the culture with pro-war propaganda, but they, more importantly, employ the techniques of understanding of mass psychology, crowd psychology, pioneered by figures like Le Bon, Trotter, and, of course, Sigmund Freud. And Edward Bernays, the sort of father of public relations, comes out of it. And at its core, they understood, as Walter Lippmann points out in his book, Public Opinion, how you manufacture consent, and that is by manipulating emotion, that people are not moved by reason or fact. And that capacity to manipulate emotion is immediately seized upon by corporations. All of these people at the end of the war go towards Madison Avenue. And that very sophisticated form of indoctrination is one that I think we have never recovered from. It ends up being a culture of permanent war, a culture of fear. And of course, as soon as the Soviet Union collapses, the iconography and language changes, but it's the same emotional response, this time towards Muslims and Islamic terrorism.
And of course, that ultimately gives rise to the celebrity culture we see today, which acts as a kind of anesthesia to some of these other issues.
Yes, the celebrity culture is, and you correctly pointed out that, you know, that the result of this is the kind of magical thinking. The celebrity culture provides a kind of the mini dramas or the pseudo events that fill our airwaves. You know, for instance, the meltdown of Charlie. I mean, there's something every week, but the meltdown of Charlie Sheen, the royal wedding brought to us by J.P. Morgan Chase, and it becomes a very effective way to propagate this notion that reality is never an impediment to what we desire. That we can have everything we want. We too can be wealthy. We too can be a celebrity if we just, dig deep enough within ourselves or grasp that we are truly exceptional or believe that Jesus can perform miracles or focus on happiness. It's just peddled to us across the political and cultural spectrum, whether it's the Christian right, whether it's Oprah, whether it's the entertainment industry. And this refusal to confront what's happening around us, this belief that somehow our economic deprivation, our inability to find a good job, our inability to advance is our fault rather than the fault of the reconfiguration of American society, the destruction of the manufacturing base. Even the New York Times the other day estimated that if there was an honest count of unemployment, it would be about 16%. The LA Times a few months before estimated 17%. These are depression level unemployment figures, and the effect of being caught up within this illusion. One strives towards a dream. One lives within an illusion. The effect of that is that you keep your populace in a state of infantilism, a state of childishness, where you don't confront reality. But as that gap opens up between the illusion of who we think we are and where we're going and the reality, when it's our home that is foreclosed, when we go bankrupt because we can't pay our medical bills, when we grasp that that job that maybe we had or our father had at a steel mill for $50 an hour with benefits, retirement plan, health insurance is not coming back, and not only not coming back for us, but not coming back for our children. As that illusion is shattered, then the danger is we react as children, which is to scream for a demagogue, a savior, moral renewal, and acts of vengeance, usually directed against scapegoats. And we have plenty here, the top of the list being, of course, Muslims and undocumented workers.
And it results from a political perspective in what you talk about as a kind of inverted totalitarianism.
That's Sheldon Wolin's term, not mine, but I think he's right. This is how he describes our political system. And by that, he means that it is not a classical form of totalitarianism. It doesn't revolve around a demagogue or charismatic leader. It is not about a radical or revolutionary party overthrowing a decaying structure and replacing it. Rather, inverted totalitarianism finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. In a system of inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to the Constitution, electoral politics, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet have seized internally the levers of power as to carry out a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion. And I think we can see it in every piece of legislation that is passed, whether that is the bailout, which had no popular support, the FISA Reform Act, which had no popular support, Obamacare, which had very little popular support and saw the corporations not only write the 2,000 pages of the legislation, but quash the public option, because of course the public option is far more economically efficient and productive, and that was an option that they didn't want presented. The jobs bill that's floating around in committee has been reduced to $6 billion in tax credits for corporations. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. The danger of a system of inverted totalitarianism is that, as we spoke before, you don't have a way by which citizens can have their legitimate grievances redressed. Everything gets funneled upwards into the hands of a rapacious and narrow elite, CEOs earning $900,000 an hour, obscene bonuses being handed out by firms like Goldman Sachs, and yet 1 in 4 children in this country now need food stamps in order to eat.
One of the things you've talked about is the divide between truth and justice on the one hand and privilege and power on the other. Can these things ever be reconciled, and should we try in that reconciliation? Is that where maybe there is some hope?
No, not in the reconciliation. I think that there have to be movements within a population that hold fast to the moral imperatives of truth and justice, and that, as Julian Benda points out in The Treason of Intellectuals, the closer you move towards privilege and power, the more concessions you make to privilege and power, the more you diminish the capacity for truth and justice. Karl Popper, in The Open Society and Its Enemies, writes that the question is not how do you get good people to rule. That's the wrong question, he argues. Most people attracted to power are at best mediocre, which in my mind is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The question is, how do you prevent the power elite from doing as much damage to you as possible? All of the correctives in American democracy never achieved formal political power. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement. And yet you could argue that at least until April 1968, the most powerful figure in the United States was Martin Luther King, because when he went to Memphis, 50,000 people went with him. Surrendering of mobilized movements, and especially labor, has rendered the average citizen, and certainly the average worker, unable to respond or unable to fight back. So compromise is certainly the art of governance, but unless you have powerful movements that remain fast around these moral imperatives, whether that's racial equality, whether that's the right of workers, within a democracy, and unless you have a structure of power by which these movements can be heard, and by which their grievances can be addressed, then your democracy collapses, as ours has, and you begin to see leaping up around the fringes of it, as we are, very frightening proto-fascist movements, which express a legitimate rage, but which take it out on weak members of society, celebrate the gun culture, celebrate the language of violence, demonize Muslims, demonize undocumented workers, demonize liberals. And I share the anger towards the liberal class. I think the liberal class, and especially in the form of the Democratic Party, did betray working men and women. But at that moment, they also reject the values this self-identified liberal class purports to defend, and then all bets are off, especially if your currency becomes unstable.
When you take all this and put it in the context of this increasingly connected and globalized world and the rise of China and all of the other movements that are happening throughout the world, how does it change the equation? How does it change the appearance?
Well, corporations are supranational. I'm not actually against capitalism. I'm just against corporate capitalism. The penny capitalism of the farmers in the farm town where I grew up, who brought their produce in and sold it, is a healthy form of capitalism. Even the regional capitalism, the local hardware store owner or factory owner who sits on the school board and pays taxes, But corporate capitalism is something else, and under the mantra of globalization and the destruction of trade barriers, it has no loyalty to the nation state. It's all about maximizing profit, even at the expense of the nation. So we have watched the dismantling of our manufacturing base, I mean, even to the point where in states like Ohio, factories were being crated up and shipped over the border to Mexico, where workers would make 90 cents an hour instead of making, you know, $15, $20 an hour. And now, of course, we see large-scale closures in Mexico as these factories go to the cut-rate embrace of China's totalitarian capitalism. And if you read about the conditions of workers in southern China, it's serfdom. Many of them aren't even paid. I mean, they finish the month and you have suicides, people jumping off the roofs, collapsing because of exhaustion, no safety protection, no right to organize. And that's what's happening, that the American workers being told that they have to be competitive in a global economy. But in essence, what they're being told is they have to be competitive with prison labor in countries like China. And that's when I use the word neo-feudalism. That's what corporations are reconfiguring, not only our own economy, but the world economy, into a situation where you have a thin middle class of corporate managers, you have an oligarchic corporate elite, and then two-thirds or more of the country live in pretty appalling conditions. I mean, the 40 million Americans or 45 million Americans who live in poverty in this country now spend about 35% of their income just to eat. And that is deeply destructive to a democracy. You can't maintain a democracy in an oligarchic state. That's something that Thucydides and Plutarch wrote about and understood. So the economic reconfiguration has very severe and dangerous political ramifications.
And it's interesting that the metaphor that's used to explain it all comes from this world of evolutionary biology, and that's supposed to be the explanation of this.
Yes, and it's a distortion, of course, of Darwin. Darwin never posited that we evolved morally. He was too good a scientist to do that. He said that species accrued mutations, and it is this kind of cult of science. This, of course, gets back to the magical thinking, the idea that we inevitably evolve, that human progress is linear and incontrovertible, and that technology and science, which are morally neutral, will somehow save us from ourselves. And in many ways, that faith in science and technology has replaced a kind of 15th or 14th century replaced a faith in God, and rendered us politically disempowered. So yes, the idea that we evolve morally, I don't think there's anything in human nature or human history to support that utopian belief. The of course tools and instruments change, but technology and science, which mostly serves the interests of corporations, is subservient to human ambition. And I think that when we look back on the 20th century and the numbers of people who have been killed because of the deadly capacity science and technology has rendered to the war machine, the creation of industrial warfare, that's sort of a good illustration of how, while certainly many wonderful things have come out of science, many deadly things have also come out of it. And finally, of course, the pollution and the degradation of the environment that is threatening to extinguish or certainly severely distort the ecosystem on which human beings depend for life.
Chris Hedges, the book is The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. It's just out from Nation Books. Chris, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.